Welcome. Good to see you. Hope you've all had a good day. My name is Mike Ritchie. I'm a freelancer, consultant, general purpose, techie guy. Hard to put a label. We're going to be talking today about software craftsmanship-driven development. But this is a particular context. And the context is, the technical context, is small devices. The types of devices that we use for embedded systems and IoT development. We're going to have some hardware examples. Maybe not with this one because it doesn't want to come out, apparently. So what happens when the pins get stuck? So small devices, the kind of code that we write for these and approaches and practices that we know work. It's going to be some hardware, it's going to be some code, but before we get into that, we need to set a little bit of context so that when we get to the techie, we all know what it is that we're looking at. Here are a lot of things that I'm largely not going to talk about. IoT is this gigantic, nebulous, vast ecosystem of interlocking parts, back-end systems, messaging systems, connectivity, you know, 4G, Wi-Fi, data analytics. What we're going to be looking at is that. We're going to look at the thing in the Internet of Things. So we're talking about the device themselves. And there are a lot of them. Now, caveat, I'm not an industry analyst, right? I don't do the kind of industry thing, but the projections for the growth in small connected devices are quite staggering, set to outstrip the number of human beings on the planet. And it's worth remembering that this is not just, I have a consumer focus, right? I'm aware of all these cool wearables, devices you can buy for your connected home and your connected car. But there's professional business applications, there's industrial applications, military, transport, whatever. It's basically virtually every economic sector you can imagine. So what is it that's driving this growth? So the first thing is the growth of the devices themselves, these small devices. And it's not really surprising, it's the continuation of a trend that's been going on since the 1970s. And a lot of this is fueled by licensing of chip cores to manufacturers from companies like ARM, who design the cores and then license them to volume manufacturers to specialize for specific purposes. So the low-cost microcontroller is ubiquitous, it's everywhere. It's estimated that in the developed economies in Western Europe, we've got about 4 general-purpose computing devices in our house. So, you know, a laptop or an iPad, something that when you're using it, you know it's a computer, right? But for those 4, there are about 30 microcontrollers in a typical house in a developed economy. So they are everywhere. A huge variety of devices, huge variety of applications. But as I said, there's a relatively small number of companies designing cores, this intellectual property that's then licensed on to volume manufacturers. They don't make silicon themselves. ARM, you have ARM chips in every iPhone, every iPad. But ARM don't manufacture silicon. They sell the intellectual property to manufacturers who then specialize that for specific or specific markets. Now, I did that diagram to kind of illustrate a point, which was that NXP had acquired Freescale, I think. But since they did it, Microchip have acquired Atmel. So this acquisition happens a lot. It's a very rapidly shifting industry and product lines move around. Okay, but the thing that's really changed the game is connectivity. So we've had microcontrollers for decades, but connectivity is what's changing the game. So for example, with smart metering in your home, it's not just the device is plugged into your electricity supply, it's plugged into your appliances in the home, but it's back-end services and data analytics that are doing the heavy lifting. So this connectivity plus the growth of devices leads us into this brave new world where you can have updatable light bulbs. You can upgrade your light bulbs. I'm going to be honest. I'm not there. You know, I'm just not cool with that yet. I quite like having an actual physical switch on the wall that sends actual electrons down the wire. But undoubtedly, there are real applications of this. You know, for energy monitoring, understanding your energy use patterns, stopping wasting energy. And when you need to update firmware, well, you really need to update firmware. This is a popular fitness wearable product. It's reading a heart rate of 119 beats per minute on a refrigerated chicken fillet. So maybe one or two things we need to fix there. That might be a setup. I don't know. I'll give the manufacturers the benefit of the doubt there. So a little checkpoint here. There's a convergence of a whole bunch of factors that are causing this buzz around IoT. It's technical enablers, it's networking, it's connectivity, it's the media frenzy, it's venture capital being shoved down the throats of any hardware startup. It's people wanting to buy stuff, wanting to buy devices. And let's not forget, it's also companies wanting your data. Right, the more data there is on your daily patterns of life and what you do in your home and what you do when you're out jogging, the better it is for them. So there's a fundamental point here, though, which is that, you know, back in the day, if you can imagine an embedded system in a washing machine 20 years ago, and there would have been one, the lifespan of that code would have been the lifespan of the device. You know, so what's the maximum run length of a washing machine? 90 minutes, let's say. So your code could fawn its ass in 91 minutes, and no one would know. No one would be any the wiser. And your code and the washing machine itself go into the skip at the end of a lifespan. But that doesn't happen now. You're expected to ship code that's going to be changed, it's going to be updated, it's going to add features for the user. So it has to be in a state that allows you to do that. So let's talk about the platforms in a wee bit more depth. There are many different physical packaging options. I'm not going to get into detail with most of them, because the one that we're going to focus on here is the microcontroller. There's a range of devices there that up to these small single board computers that could be quad core 64-bit processors on them, you know, something akin to your desktop in a small device. We're talking about something a little bit more down market than that. So we're going to focus on microcontrollers for this talk. Let me caveat this. This is not advice. Right? I'm not telling you what choices you should make when you're thinking about the type of device you've got and the type of application you have. But it's an interesting thought experiment. So what I'm trying to do here is show a graph which shows you the capability of the device from very low CPU and very low memory on one end to high capability on the other end, and what I would call the axis of frivolity. How serious is this application? Is it a safety critical application, or is it a novelty? You know, because the way you would treat a heart rate monitoring system for, you know, a professional healthcare application is very different from the code that goes in a novelty LED Christmas tree that plays jingle bells when you switch it on and it gets sold in December and then put in the bin in January. Now, I'm not suggesting you would write bad code for trivial things, but there are different factors in play. So you have decisions to make about the language. Do I use dynamic memory or not? Do I use third-party libraries or not? A lot of really tough calls that you have to make. And obviously it's not just a quadrant, it's a continuum. We can't simplify that too much because we're developers and we don't have the luxury of being simple-minded, right? We've got to take all the factors into consideration. So not advice. Just a thought experiment. We're going to be looking at these devices. We're going to be looking at the ARM Cortex series, a Cortex M series rather. So ARM have got different families of microcontroller. They have the A family, application family, which is what's in your iPhone and your Android phone, Android tablet, typically. The R series is for real-time applications. And the Cortex-M is for microcontroller applications, controlling stuff, as the name suggests. And we're going to look at one that's kind of slap bang in the middle there, Cortex-M3, when we get to the hardware part. So this is the typical sort of internal architecture of, this is the STMicroelectronics STM32F411. I'm sure we're all familiar with it. But there's a point I would make, which is that this thing in turquoise here, that big block in the middle, that's the bit that's been licensed from ARM. STMicroelectronics take that core and they add on peripherals that add value for the customer, the designers, the coders. So system functions, controllers, timers, memory, obviously, connectivity, various serial protocols, secure digital I/O, and much analog. We live in a very analog world, right? So analog to digital conversion is still a fundamental responsibility of microcontrollers. So although we call these things peripherals, they are not peripherals in the way that we would understand them. They're not mice and keyboards and printers that are separate from the machine. All of that stuff sits on a single physical package. In fact, that one there, about sort of pinky nail sized. Okay, you can run operating systems of a form on these. There are various real-time operating systems. ARM have launched an operating system specifically for IoT, a thing called Embed. Has anyone heard of this yet? Has anyone dabbled with it? You had a play? So this is targeting IoT development specifically. Linux Foundation have launched a new real-time operating system called Zephyr. FreeRTOS has been around for ages, and there's various proprietary options as well. Windows are in the game, obviously. There's a thing called Embedded. They've rebranded and sort of repositioned their operating systems recently, so I'm not entirely au fait with what they have aligned to different segments, but Windows 10 IoT, of course, is out. Available on the Raspberry Pi, am I right?
Yeah.
Has anyone tried it on
there?
Does it work? Great. Okay, well, must have a dabble. That's on the do list then. Okay, we are going to be talking about bare metal build. This is what a bare metal build looks like. Not a very complex architecture, is it? So it's your code and the hardware, and that's it. So no operating system, nothing else. You want to write to a pin. If I want to make that thing go from 0 volts to 3.3 volts, I set a register in memory. So just memory mapped input output, memory mapped pins. Now I write the right value to that location, 3.3 volts duly arrives in the pin. So it's simple, but with that simplicity comes a little bit of a hazard, because I could do that from there. I could do it from there. I could do it from there. I could do it from there as well. So I can write to hardware from anywhere in this big block that is my code. So the point is that the design that we arrive at that sits in there is entirely down to us. I don't know if anybody works in kind of enterprise applications, do you? You work in, so you're probably used to, I guess, a physical separation of stuff, right? You've got a database over here, you've got a message broker over there, you've got a web server over there. And that's, I'm not saying that leads to good design, but it does enforce some separation of concerns. That isn't the case here. It's up to you to decide what that design is going to look like in your code. So this is sometimes exacerbated a little bit by the tooling. This is code that's generated from a tool that I use for these devices. It gives you kind of startup configuration. There are two extremely dangerous lines on there. Don't know if anybody can spot what those are. Any guesses? It's kind of a trick question. Not dangerous in the sense of instability, but dangerous in the sense of what might happen if you were to take that message literally. So the manufacturers provide board support packages and APIs that help us to get started quickly with new builds. and they'll have various hook points in them. And that's fine, it's okay, and you have to use that. You have to write some code to glue together the board functions with your problem. But if you were to take that too literally and just start to write your implementation in there and keep going, that would be a bad thing, depending on the complexity of your system. It'd be very tempting just to write a little bit of code in there to say, well, I'm going to blink an LED. That's cool. So now I'll do a read of an analog to digital conversion. I'll put that in there. And that's cool. That seems to work as well. And then you keep going, and what you've got is a bunch of very hardware-specific code, and your problem, the problem you're trying to solve, just munged in there with a great deal of thought as to architecture and design. Okay, there's a key principle that helps us with this. Are you familiar with solid principles? Have you heard of this concept? It's in quite common currency. So the key one that I want to focus on today is the dependency inversion principle, which is this concept that you don't have high-level concerns depending on low-level concerns. You split that dependency by having shared abstractions. And we'll look at a concrete example of that. So this is a simplification, but I'm going to say that there are broadly two categories of code that we write when we're building these kind of systems. There's problem domain code. That's the business logic, if I can put it that way. And then there's solution domain code, the stuff that enables your problem to be solved, but isn't the problem solution in itself. Or more colloquially, techie stuff, businessy stuff. Techie stuff on this side, businessy stuff on that side. That's also split into the stuff that you write and the stuff that comes from the manufacturer in the form of APIs and libraries that you can use to make your life a little bit easier. Not easy, just slightly easier. Okay, so a little checkpoint before we go on. So we're looking at microcontrollers, we're looking at bare metal builds, and we're looking at this challenge of the design being down to us, entirely what we make of it, and the kind of principles that we follow for that. Any questions before I move on? Cool. Okay, so we'll look at the hardware example. I'm going to get into the smart home business. That looks quite lucrative. I think there's a few bucks to be made in that. So I do have my first product offering. It's pretty compelling, I have to say. It's a crowded market, right? There's a lot of stuff, you know, Google, Nest, all this stuff. But I think I have a winner here because I think aesthetically it beats the pants off the competition. It's version 1.0. Minimum lovable product. So yes, exclusively for DDD Scotland 2016, I have knocked this together as a simple example. It's trivial, but sometimes you've got to look at trivial stuff to when you're thinking about principles and how you approach quite specific design problems. So smart home, let me take you through how this thing works. It has a buzzer. The buzzer doesn't work. I glued the buzzer to the board and then discovered that it didn't work. and then decided just to leave it there rather than risk trying to take it off. But good news, there's another buzzer, which I found at the bottom of a box of parts. Professional. This was all last night, by the way. So this one I think works. Don't quote me on that. We have unique fire extinguisher. I didn't actually put the fire extinguisher on here. In fact, I've lost the damn thing. But my original, oh, there it is, right? There's a detail. You see, it's a fire detector, right? So there's a miniature fire extinguisher there, which again is stuff that was just lying around. So the potentiometer there is just to simulate CO2 levels, is the way I've coded this. Turns out the conference venues have got all sorts of opinions about you starting actual fires. They don't like it, apparently, so we're stuck with that, just a simulation. The smarts are provided by one of these, which is an ARM Cortex-M3. It's a company called ST Microelectronics, who I mentioned earlier on, so It's a very, very middle of the road, typical microcontroller, quite general purpose. You could use it for many different application types, not specialized. And LEDs, of course. No hardware demo complete without LEDs. I'm gonna plug this in and see if the damn thing works, actually. I didn't test this today, which is probably a bit of an oversight. It's not impressive, don't be. Don't get your expectations up. It burst into life. We have a green LED. We turn the level up. It goes to amber. It goes to red. And that's it. Yeah, it's awesome, isn't it? That's it, by the way. That's, thanks for coming. It's been great. So it's a daft example, but as I said, sometimes you have to simplify in order to look at some fundamentals. So it's one sensor, and it's one sensor and currently just a few outputs, three LEDs, and all it does is it reads the value, decides whether it's over, looks a bit dangerous threshold, I'm a bit suspicious about this, and then it goes over a real danger threshold and goes to red. Yep. Okay. So, yeah, that's cool, but code. Let me see, I'm going to have to kind of unmirror this screen, so bear with me a second. Turn that off. So we're going to be doing this with, we're talking about kind of modern agile engineering approaches, so I'm going to be using highly advanced IDE. Does anyone want to guess what the choice, what's the current choice of modern IDE, highly capable IDE? Sorry? Notepad. Oh, one up from that, Emacs. Right. Oops, just lost my microphone there. Is that legible to people? Can you see that okay? Cool. Okay. So we were talking about, bear with me, let's get back to this. We're talking about that model. So we're talking about the separation of concerns between the technical functions and our problem domain, like the business logic. So what I want to do first is just take you through some of these shared abstractions. And it's pretty simple stuff because it's a simple problem. So essentially the design of this mirrors the physical design of the board, right? So we've got our smart home system, which is the containing thing. We've got our sensor, which is our CO2 sensor, which doesn't do much other than lets us read values. We have our status display, which just takes an enumeration. So we just tell it this is safe, or it's suspicious, or it's alarming. Not so sure about the names there. I might have to rework those. And we have the alarm itself, which is a work in progress, not actually complete. You will have noticed that you didn't hear the buzzer go off when it went to red earlier on. Okay, so these are the shared set of abstractions that our code depends on. So the implementation code is written to that those abstractions, and it will implement the sensor, and it will implement the buzzer, and it will implement the LEDs. And that's doing things to write to pins and read from analog to digital converters and stuff that my core problem domain doesn't really want to know about. It just wants to do the logic. Okay, so those are my abstractions. Let's look at the test. Well, I'll run the test first, and then we'll just zoom this up and have a look at what we've got. So we've got tests there that I think are reasonably expressive. I mean, I'm reasonably happy with the test names. I think these give a decent sort of indication as to the way the system should behave. And that's what you want from tests, right? Tests are there partly for documentary value as well as regression and as well as helping you do your design. So I've got tests for my smart home system that verifies that when the CO2 levels are safe, it does things with the alarm, it applies, assesses the level as suspicious or alarming, and it does that by verifying that the call to my status display happens with the right value in it. My status display, well, that's got slightly more technical language in it, right? Because that's going to be setting pins. So we'll have a look at the test for that and for the sensor. The sensor, again, is dealing with analog to digital conversion. And you can see it's got quite a lot of technical concerns in there around the failure or success of that conversion process. And it just has to. There's some inescapable grunge in there. So eventually, something has to talk to the hardware, right? You can put more and more layers of indirection and abstraction on there, but you're not really getting anything other than adding more code and pushing the problem further away. So I have code that has a technical function dealing with pins and converters, and I have code that has the logical function, which is deciding what to do with that sensory input and then take the appropriate action. Yep, turn on an LED, make the buzzer go buzz, whatever. So we'll look at a test. We'll look at the smart home system. Smart home test. I'm using a framework here called CPPUtest, which is quite a nice framework for embedded systems development. It's not heavyweight, it doesn't use much of the C++ standard library. In fact, I think it uses none of the C++ standard library. So you can run these tests actually on the device as well. I'm not going to be doing that today, but it is possible. It has a very lightweight mocking framework. So you can see what I have here. This is the code that's at the heart of that business logic. There's a mocked status display, which is mocking out the function of these three LEDs. There's a mocked buzzer, which is mocking that, which gets turned on and off, or mock alarm, as I called it there. And there's a mock sensor, which I'm using to prime the values that come back from our analog to digital conversion. And I have tests for, as I said, reading the carbon dioxide level, quote unquote, turning the potentiometer, and then doing the appropriate thing. Yep. So in this case, I just want to know that when I ask the system to update itself, that it goes and looks at the sensor, and that's pretty fundamental. If that wasn't working, then you know this is not safe for the person whose house the alarm system is in. Looking at the wiring on this, I'm not really sure it's safe for that person anyway. There's a little bit of a hazard there, but we'll skip over that. That's cool. We then have other tests for what happens when the CO2 level is below a safe limit. Well, it should light the LED to be green. And again, it's doing this by mocks. And it's trying to work out the collaboration between my core business logic and how it interacts with other parts of the system. And these were used to drive out the design of these other parts of the system as well. So you start by discovering the interfaces and the boundaries and the interactions between your core logic, sensor, the status display, and the buzzer. And then you turn to implementation of those. So that's using quite clean language. You're looking at that, it's using problem domain language. There's nothing there about pins. There's nothing there about analog to digital conversion. There's no use of vendor APIs, pure logic, yep, completely separate from the board concerns. If I look at the sensor test as an example, well, that's quite different, right? You can see what's starting to creep in there is failure cases, return codes back from vendor APIs that we tried to do an analog to digital conversion, but it timed out. Well, what do we do about that? We have to signal an error. We do that just by turning an LED on and leaving it on. It just kind of enters an error state. So all of these, both happy paths and unhappy paths, for the technical aspect of the implementation, we're doing in these tests. So the tests you'll find are either very technical or the tests are very business logic-y. This is a technical one. Okay. Any questions so far before I move on? You kind of get the mocks and interactions thing. Probably doing a lot of this in your own code. And there's a point I'll be making later on, but I'll say it now. It's not drastic. There are some things about embedded systems development that are a bit weird, a bit unique, constraints in particular on memory and CPU. But there are some things which are just horribly familiar to every single developer, and that's just dealing with dependencies. Now, if you want to write code that it's working against a database, but you don't want to be connected to the database. You have to deal with that. And it's exactly the same working on embedded systems development. And the best hedge against having dependencies on hardware is to not code on the hardware. Right, so all of this code, I press my magic button and I'm running tests and nothing connected to the board. Honestly, it's not running on that. That's just being used for power. Right, so if you really want to not depend on hardware, don't depend on hardware. It's that simple. Write your tests and do your TDD and your developer ID running on your host machine, which is a Linux box in this case, and then subsequently wire that stuff up to the implementation. Cool, okay. So this is going great. I'm really quite happy with this implementation, but yeah, there's trouble. Right. So I started on this yesterday, didn't have time to finish it. You'll notice that the buzzer didn't go off when I turned the potentiometer around. Boss isn't happy. Boss wants me to get this in. So I'm going to finish off what I started yesterday. So what we're going to do is just go through a couple of TDD cycles, red, green, refactor, just on this last little missing bit of implementation. Then we'll deploy the changed binary to this board and see if it works. Pray that it works, might be a better description. Okay, so I've done some of the work here. Let me go back to the smart home test. So yesterday what I did is I did the cases for the interaction to kind of figure out what the alarm should look like. So I wrote a test that said CO2 level is dangerous, the alarm should be sounded. I know that's happening, but it's happening against a mock object, right? I've got to do real implementation now. I did the test for it's suspicious and it's safe. Well, that turns off the alarm, right? So I know that the kind of business logic is right. I know the interactions are right, but nothing's actually happening because nothing's wired to pins on the board. So I've got to make a pin go to 3.3 volts and my buzzer sounds. Okay, so I'm going to go to my alarm test. Actually, I'm just going to make one small change to the CMake file just to drop the verbosity of the tests. It's a little bit heavyweight, the output. It's going to be a little bit disruptive. That's nicer. Okay. So, I need a test group. CPPU test, you always need a test group. All tests have to belong to groups, just the way it works. So I'm going to call it alarm. That makes sense. And I'm going to write a test for alarm. And there are only really two things that happen here. The alarm either gets told to be on or it gets told to be off, and it just has to do the appropriate thing. So now what I'm doing is I'm testing that when it gets told to be on, that it sets the right voltage or writes to the right pin, which results in the right voltage, which results in the buzzer going off. So when turned on, sets alarm pin high. Two-finger typing, and apologies for all the finger fluffs. I'm not used to coding on a laptop. Getting my excuses in early, as you can see. So target, alarm. So this is my system under test. It's the alarm is the thing I'm testing. There it is. Just hit recompile. Recompile and retest reflexively. It's just something I do all the time. You just, if you're doing this, just have a hotkey defined and just keep pressing it. So you're going to find that compiler output appearing all the time. So for the alarm to be working, for the success condition here is that it speaks to the board in the right way. So it's a board API call that sets a pin on. So I use a mock object for that. And I'm expecting a call. And the call is write pin. That's a constant value, which I've defined elsewhere, by the way. It's just the CPPU test bases parameters and method names just on strings, and it just matches strings. It's quite primitive in that respect. But lightweight and quite effective. I'm expecting a parameter, and the pin should be alarm pin. All right, there's a lot of pins. If I turn on the wrong one, well, that's not good. And there's another parameter I expect, which is that I'm setting it on. Right, so it's the same. We'll see this when we look at the implementation, but it's the same call that's used to switch a pin on or switch a pin off. So I want to make sure it's been told to go on. So pin state, I think it is, GPIO, GPIO set, is it? GPI will pin this in. There we go. So that's my mock. So remember TDD, where it's red, green, refactor. So what I'm really trying to do is get to a red state. I'm trying to get to a failing state, but I'm not doing anything yet. So the mock has an expectation. I'm not verifying the expectations, which is why it's passing. So what I'm going to do is invoke my implementation on the alarm. So my system under test, switch it on. Still not failing, because what I have to do is on my mocks, check the expectations. Now we get a failure, okay? So I'm expecting that the alarm is going to do something. I'm expecting that it's going to write to a pin. It ain't doing it, so the mock is saying, whoa, wait a minute, I expected to be interacted with, it hasn't happened, that's red. And the red's what I want, so I've got my failing test to start with. So what I'm going to do is flip to my implementation, and I'm going to make that pass. Okay, so that was a stub API from yesterday when I sneaked out without the boss looking. So now I need to invoke the implementation. So that's going to talk to the board. How GPIO write pin. There's a port that I have to talk to. There is the pin. And there's the value that I need to set in there. Okay. So my mock, green bar. So my mock is verifying a call to a vendor API. And it's obviously doing this on my developer machine here. It's not doing it on the board. Yep. So I can verify my business logic. I can verify that my code interacts with the vendor API in the right way. And at some point, I've got to glue them together, but we're going to do that by just a bit of exploratory testing by deploying to the board. So I'm happy with that, but I'm not really happy with this test. I'm going to do a little bit of, so one of the nice things about TDD, right, is continuous refactoring, you remove duplication, you look for opportunities to clean up your code. So there's a couple of things there that look common to me, so I'm going to pull out that instantiation of my alarm. That's going to be used for all the tests. And I'm also going to put a teardown method in here, which does my mock expectation check, because again, going to be doing that in more than one place. Okay, test will pass. So I've done a little bit to just pull out some commonality there. So my next test and final test for this one, when turned off, sets alarm pin low. Okay. Similar story, so mock expecting a single call to write pin. Bad keyboard day. Alarm pin. And this time the parameter is pin state, GPIO pin reset. So that's the way that we signal I want this to go back to 0 volts, a logical zero rather than a logical one. Alarm off. Okay, run the tests. What have I done? Oh yeah, there we go. You're not dissing Emacs, are you? I'm just not going to have that. All right, this will get messy if you're doing that. So I have a failure now. So failure of expectations again, where it's expecting the value to be set into the vendor API, into this HAL API. It's not happening. I'm going to be lazy. Don't do this at home. I figure it's that you sit and watch me do typos for the next 5 minutes. So we'll just try and expedite this a little bit, right? Okay, run, yay. Okay, result, so we got green bar again. So the business logic, my TDD yesterday, figured out the interactions between different component parts of the system. The implementation code, the stuff that's specific to the board, specific to the target, well, we've just done that. against the API from STMicroelectronics. And what remains now is for us to get it onto here and see if the buzzer gives buzz. So I'm going to do another build. This time I'm doing it against the, so I'm cross-compiling now for the ARM target. Okay, so it's a 32-bit target. The way CMake works is just have different subdirectories for different build targets. I won't bore you with the details. Something up there. Okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm just going to try and regenerate the CMake build. Bear with me a second. I know what it is. I've just got some intermediate file which is kicking around for some reason. That unsaved changes was all it was. Okay, run my build. Okay, I've got a hex file out, and I'm now going to try and upload that to the board. I'm going to do that using a tool called OpenOCD, which is just something that sits between my debugger and the ST-Link debugger that's sitting on this. And I am going to do what? I'm going to telnet here. Okay, so this is a bit tedious. Basically, I have a software daemon that's sitting running that's there to help the debugging process. I'm telnetting to that, and then I'm able to invoke commands that will result in stuff happening on this board. It's a bit baroque, it's a bit kind of complex, but we'll do it. So I'm going to halt the chip execution. You can see that there's no LED light on now. I'm going to write the image to the board. Takes a little while, something to think about it. And we're good. And I'm going to run. So, built the binary on here, just moved it across to this device, and now I'm just going to kick off the device again, let it run again. Okay, so we're in green. This is genuinely tense, actually. This would be such a disaster. I'm selling like the benefits of TDD. TDD is really important. And okay. Yeah. So, I mean, just to reiterate, the point of doing this is the benefits of TDD. Oops. The benefits of TDD are to help you, it's a design process, right? It's to help you arrive at a good design on your code. The benefits of TDD and running it on your host machine in the context of embedded systems development is just immense. It's immeasurable, right? You can see the kind of speed of the development cycle I was able to do there when I was coding in my IDE versus, I say IDE, I meant Emacs. But it's an IDE, right? Trust me. Versus the speed of having to deploy to the device. And when you start to get into debugging on the chip, debugging on hardware, it's a slow process. Even if you script it, even if you invest a lot of time in automating, it's just intrinsically slower than being able to just write and run code in your editor and in your build, right? So if you really want a very fluid design process where you're getting very fast feedback on your code, do it off the hardware and then check on the hardware. You're still going to have to run it on the actual target device. It would be insane to go off for you know, days or weeks or months and not run it on the actual target. You still have to do that. The fastest feedback that you're going to get is going to be by writing tests and running them on your host machine. And obviously, the tests are an enabler for all sorts of other goodies. Continuous integration is something that we all should be doing, but I would make the point that continuous integration without tests just isn't continuous integration. It's continuous build. All you're doing is checking compilation compatibility of the changes you've made with the other developers' changes. And you just don't get the same feedback with a test-last approach. A selling point for TDD, almost on its own, you know, despite even all the design stuff that we've talked about, being able to get fast feedback on your developer machine, is also to use dynamic analysis tools to leverage the tests that you've written. There are some fantastic open source tools, sanitizers, you might have heard of them. Clang has a really nice suite of sanitizers for checking undefined behavior, address sanitizers, so it's checking that you don't try and read uninitialized memory, that you don't try and use memory after it's been freed. It can check for memory leaks. If you're working in a multi-threaded environment as well, it can transfer thread sanitization to make there are no deadlocks and data races. The thing about these tools is that they're completely predicated on tests. If your code doesn't run, these tools won't pick anything up. It's not like static analysis where you show your entire code base and say, hey, go and have a look at that and tell me if there's anything wrong with it. What these tools do, these dynamic tools, is they verify that for a particular set of inputs, your code went down a path that did a bad thing or a potentially unsafe thing. But that only happens with the tests. And the best way to have tests is to write tests. And the best way to have tests and write tests is to write them first. Soapbox dismount. Okay, so yeah, that was a bit codey. TDD, just to make the point, it works in any language. If you can make test-driven development work in C++, in Emacs, with makefiles, it'll work on anything. Trust me, this is not a friendly sort of set of tools and languages to be doing this stuff with. But there are some things there that are really quite universal as well. I mean, I've said that there are specifics to embedded, and there undoubtedly are. But it's still just code, and it's still just code running in something. And everything that you interact with, whether it's analog to digital converters, whether it's GPIO pins, whether it's serial connections over I2C and SPI and these kind of standard protocols, it's just dependencies. It's just more and more dependencies. And we've got ways of dealing with that. We know how to do that, and we just have to do it. Okay, the tale of woe. It's what can go wrong when we don't code this way. There was a case back in the late 2000s of an embedded system. This is not IoT. This is not frivolous stuff. This is not your light bulb coming on or your kind of novelty Christmas tree. This is like serious safety critical embedded, but it's much the same sort of development approaches. So in this car, this range of cars, there was a problem which was started to get phrased unintended acceleration. The car just would speed up and you hadn't done anything to make that happen. And the finger was pointed at what was called an electronic throttle control system, ETCS. NASA had a look at this code in a fairly tight time window, but they found some. I've got to say, this is contested. The output of this is contested. The manufacturer says, no, that was not the cause. NASA say, well, you know, look at the code. And everyone else says, yeah, it was. That's what the problem was. But it's not. There was never any conclusive proof. But even if you put that to one side and just look at some of the stats that came out of there, over 11,000 global mutable variables. Right. The holy grail in embedded systems development is deterministic behavior. Right. You want to know that stuff is going to behave in a predictable way repeatedly. Global mutable state is the sworn enemy of deterministic behavior. It's the worst thing that you can do. And on top of that was complexity as well. There was one key method that had a cyclomatic complexity number of 146. I I can't even really picture what that would look like. It's an awful lot. There were many other methods that had CCNs over 50, so there was an extremely complex code in there. And when you take complexity, and you couple that complexity to global state, unmanaged global state, and no unit tests, you're not in for a happy ride, and neither are your drivers, unfortunately. So, but it doesn't have to be that way. We have ways of dealing with complex problems and highly constrained environments, doing TDD, continuous integration, running the tools, continuous refactoring, and simple design. Going to leave you some words of wisdom from Herb Sutter and Andre Alexandrescu. This is the best book written on C++, in my opinion. So he said that it's far, far easier to make a correct program fast than it is to make a fast program correct. Concentrate on getting it right. Don't start to optimize. Don't start to assume that just because I'm working on a particular type of problem that I have to do these optimizations that may make my code run faster. Get it right and optimize when it's right. Stuff to read. Some great books here. James Grenning book, just buy that. Even if you're not doing this, just buy it. It's a great read. It's a fantastic book. So what that guy doesn't know about doing TDD and what he doesn't know about embedded systems just isn't worth knowing. So that's real from the trenches stuff. James Grenning, incidentally, was one of the top line signatories on the Agile Manifesto as well. So he's clearly a guy with ideas and opinions. Great book. Jeff Langer's book, also very good. Not specific to embedded, but still worth a read. Michael Feathers. So it might seem odd talking about legacy code in the context of what might be new development, but actually a lot of Michael Feathers' ideas about how you find these, what he calls seams in the code, where you can kind of interpose your test doubles into, there's some very wise words in there. Definitely worth a read. Thank you very much. It's been fun.